Hello, this is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. I'm Doug Rademacher. Today is March 15th, 2006. The time is about 10 minutes after 1 in the afternoon, and we are at the UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. First, we'll introduce the team.
Cheryl McCoy.
John Fedewa.
Gary Judy.
Earl Nicholson.
Josefina Martinez.
Jerry Smith.
And Doug Rademacher. Today we are interviewing Carl Taborski. Would you please state your name and spell it for the record?
My name is Carl Frank Taborski II, spelled K-A-R-E-L. Frank is a normal people spell. Taborski, T-A-B-O-R-S-K-Y.
And what is your address?
My current address is 2311 Cumberland Road, Lansing, Michigan.
Are you married?
No.
Do you have any children?
Yes.
And what do you have, sir?
I have a 26-year-old daughter from a previous marriage.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Flint, Michigan, and I lived there probably for 3 years. Lived up on Pingree Street by the old brewery, by I-75 there. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but we lived back in that neighborhood area. My grandfather had a store there, and I lived there for a while. And then we moved to Ypsilanti, Michigan, where my father attended Eastern Michigan, it was Michigan State Normal College at the time. And we lived there till I was about 4 or 5, and then we moved to Holt for a half a year, and I attended school there the Elliott School. And then we moved over on Butler Street, 320 North Butler, and lived there for 4 years. My dad taught at Sexton High School. I attended Tennessee Street School until the fourth grade. Then we moved over to the house on South Tennessee Street between the summers of fourth and fifth grade. And that's where I spent a lot of time until I took off on my own after the service got a hold of me. And then I moved to my current, I actually lived several places out in East Lansing and all the good party spots to live, and that's where I live. And then I bought a farm, home on Holmes Road, Holmes Road, where a friend of mine, Doug Rademacher, helped me work on my house, and we rebuilt that. And then I got married and bought a farm out in Bath, and was there until I got divorced, and then I moved to the Lansing Towers Apartments, lived there for 7 years, and then I moved over onto Cumberland Road, where I've been since, for the last 10, 15 years. I don't know. Time flies when you get old.
Thank you. Were you in the military?
Yes, I was. I was a draftee. As I told one of the gentlemen here today, that I don't go any place unless I'm invited, and Uncle Sam was happy to invite me. I went down to Fort Knox for my basic training, and for my advanced individual training, I ended up in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as an artillery trainee, and got my month of leave, and then I went over to Vietnam, and of course, they put me in a target acquisition section, counter-mortar, counter-rocket radar. And I had a lot of fun there. I extended so I wouldn't have to spend any more time in the service. I spent 14 months over there, probably no more than a mile off the Cambodian border most of the time, in the Highway 13, wherever stuff was happening, that's where they put the radar section. Do our thing and locate the mortars and rockets that were being fired at us, et cetera, et cetera. Engaged in a lot of combat, awful lot of combat, probably 60 to 70 times in that particular time, many times for 2 to 3 days. It was very frightening at the time, but as minds do, they just forget the bad. And you remember the fun parts, which you used to do, go with the mortar platoon, have some fun, this kind of stuff that we won't talk about on tape.
Okay. You shared about your grandfather in Flint had a store. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother was a housewife, and my father was a very highly respected instructor right down here most of the time at J.W. Sexton High School. He taught auto shop, general mechanics, and metal shop. And there, doing that, in essence, as a child, I spent a lot of time working with my dad over to school when he'd be grading papers, and I'd be running the machines. I could run just about any machine there, lathe, milled, and everything by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, which gave me a great appreciation for mechanical things.
Now, just to put some feeling into it, where exactly, how close was your parents' home to the Fisher Body plant?
Well,
and where was the Sexton High School you speak of?
Sexton High School sat just to the extreme south end of Fisher Body. In fact, one of the fields that we use for like football and the track field faced, building 3X, but that used to be a parking lot before they put that stuff in. I watched that being built. My parents' house was probably less than a half a block from the plant proper. I used to kind of joke that I had to, when I lived at home and worked at the plant, that I walked further from the front door of the plant to where I worked in the plant than I did from my house to the front door of the plant.
Carol, would you share a little bit about growing up next to an assembly plant?
Well, it was interesting. We used to watch the guys back before they blanked off all the windows. You know, we used to harass them and pick on them a little bit. Fisher Body was always a tremendous neighbor for our neighborhood. My mom, quite a forceful person. If there was problems back in the old days, because the bond right and the paint ovens and the paint shop was on the east side of the plant, and there's a lot of paint fumes from the weekends, you know, from the stale water that they used to collect the overspray of the paint. And when they start the ovens up, it was probably one of the more interesting smells you'll ever smell, kind of a cross between a dead horse and a rotten egg, literally. And my mom would call, and they'd come to some sort of remediation for it. They were always very solicitous of the neighbors if they had a problem. I don't understand why people, you know, move next door to Fisher or whatever we're called now, and then complain about it. You know, if you move next door to a pig farm, it's going to smell. So don't move next door to a pig farm. But Fisher Body's not a pig farm. In fact, when they built the new part of the plant, I went through some records looking for some stuff, and GM actually spent $250,000 to build a model of the plant as it would be with the new paint shop. With the new paint shop, and wind tunnel tested it to check for inversion and stuff like that, so this the fumes and whatever wouldn't affect the neighborhood.
Do you have any stories that you remember of the trains, the trucks, any of the things that you did around the plant, and maybe there was something that resembled a coach out front?
There was out in front of the, and that's something that always just fascinated me as a child, was that they used to have the, what do they call that guy? Well, anyway, they had large Fisher Body floral display, if you want to call it, with the Fisher Body coach right out on the, what would be the northeast corner. It was a large thing. The gardener, they actually had a full-time gardener in those days. They'd lay him off during the winter, and he'd work during the summer taking care of the, it's almost like topiary. He'd clip the flowers, and it was just fascinating. I just used to go over there and look at it all the time. It was pretty cool, I thought.
There's a place called Harry's Bar, Harry's Place.
Yeah.
Was that an intricate part of your growing up at all?
Well, it was kind of fun because I don't remember if it was Mario or Art, but Ole, we used to call her Mrs. Harry, and Mr. Harry used to live on the second floor there. And as kids, we used to, you know, play baseball in the vacant lot, which would be to the be to the east of the plant. And we used to hit the balls up on the top of his roof. And, of course, he really didn't care for that too much. And we also used to pick up the beer bottles that the factory folks would sit when they just leave in the parking lot. And then, you know, 2 cents was 2 cents back then. And we kids would go get it and off quite often get chased out of there because we were running off of their money, in essence. And that was always big fun, you know.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do.
Okay, well, we'll move on. Why did you hire into Fisher Body?
Well, I got out of the service, and I went back to my job at Demmer Tool and Die. And at that time, the tool and die industry, in fact, the American auto industry was really starting to feel the pinch of the early 70s. The gasoline and all this stuff, plus the manufacturing methods were changing a lot. There was a lot more computer stuff going on. Very, very primitive stuff. So anyway, basically I got laid off. And so I went drag racing. That's the first thing you do when you get laid off. And a couple friends of I, we put together a race car, a 69 Camaro, 427 automatic. And we went what we thought was pretty professional racing. We did that for the whole thing was about 5 years. But in the interim, that my unemployment ran out. And my dad, being a teacher, brought home a piece of paper, and he says, he told me basically, boy, he says, you take this test, you're going to get a job. You're not going racing for a living. So I went over and took the test because I was told to, because I've always been a very good child. And so I didn't worry about it. I went racing. Well, the lady next door to me, Elizabeth Curry, she used to be the plant controller. And so my folks were pretty friendly with her. And she came over one day and she says, you know, you better get Carl over there to get his apprenticeship, to check on his apprenticeship, because they can't put any apprentices until he shows up. Well, you know, that piqued my interest, so I went over and I talked to R.J. Kushma, who was the apprentice coordinator at the time. And he and I had a conversation. He was very glad to see me because at the time you could sign up for all of the trades, whatever trade you wanted. And I didn't sign up for any of them, but I had scored high enough on the apprenticeship test that by the process by which they selected apprentices, me being the highest, I could have any apprenticeship I wanted, so they couldn't hire any implant people until they put me someplace. So I got there and I said, they asked me what I wanted to be. I said, I want to be a tool and die maker. And they said, well, we don't have that. I said, well, what's the closest? This is a tool maker. And I said, well, I'll be a tool maker. And they said, well, you don't want to be a tool maker because we got tool maker apprentices laid off. One's been laid off for 2 years. And I said, well, fine. What's a millwright? I figured a millwright ran a mill because I had a tool and die background. I ran a lot of machines, and one of the machines I ran was a mill, so I figured they ran a mill. He says, no, those guys lift and carry, basically, and weld and move stuff around. And I says, well, what one pays the most? And they said, an electrician. I says, I'll be an electrician. And that's how I got in.
Okay. That's interesting. When did you hire in to Fisher Body?
The 6th of July, 1971. And I knew that I was going to like this job because I hired in, worked for a week, and got laid off for a week. And I thought this was going to be the best job in the world, working half-time, because that wouldn't interfere with my racing activities. But later I found out it was just a way to the four guys that came on as electricians with me so they could have a date of entry earlier than mine because they were plant people. And that didn't bother me a bit. So that's why my seniority date's the way it is.
Okay. Did you have any other family members that worked at Fisher Body?
No, not that I'm aware of. My dad worked for Kaiser Frazier, but that doesn't count, does it?
Not at this point, but
okay.
It's important. How old were you when you hired into the plant?
I don't know. How old am I now? I think I was 23. Yeah, 23. I think I would have been 23 or 24 on that next October after that July that I hired in.
And what shift and department did you hire into?
Well, the maintenance department. I hired in right off the street as an apprentice, as I've said, as an electrician. And I started out what we call now the central maintenance area. But back then, basically, all the trades, with the exception of the Weimers that worked out in the body shop, that's welder equipment maintenance and repair, they worked out in the body shop, and the rest of the calls were taken out, any trouble calls were taken from the central shop. We'd all get on a blitz buggy and like a bunch of Keystone cops and hang off the side of it and go off and take care of whatever the problems were.
Well, you seem like a very qualified guy.
Oh, I'm qualified.
For what you took the test, you were tops in the scoring, and you got to pick your choice. Now tell me, can you remember your first day on the job? And what was it like knowing that you grew up across the street, you walk in this building, where'd they take you, what'd they do with you that day?
Well, another fellow and I, Kenny Eichelberger. Kenny Eichelberger hired in off the street as an apprentice also. We were the first two guys that were hired off of the street into the trades on the apprenticeship probably in 10 to 12 years. And as it turned out, it was another 12 or so years before they hired anybody else in off the street. So I figured that had something to do with the quality of the people that we were. My first day on the job, we walked in the front entrance, we walked down the steps past plant security, rather apprehensive, and went up there, and it wasn't Jerry Brooks. I can't remember the name of the guy that interviewed me, but just basically, did just a few questions and determined my suitability for the job, and off I went. And my first supervisor was Al Jackson, bless his heart. Just an absolute superman, as far as I'm concerned. One of the finest gentlemen I've ever known. He's since passed. So he showed me around. He said, "Glad to have you pulling sparks with us." That's the first thing he said to me. And went around and met the fellas and got assigned to probably the grouchiest old journeyman that they could. They're going to test the kid. Well, I came in there with virtually no electrical knowledge other than some minor houseware. And I worked with this guy, and he was totally convinced that I was unsuitable for the job because I didn't know anything. And I informed him that, of course, I don't know anything. I'm an apprentice. I'm here to learn. Teach me something. So that day, he went to Al Simpson, who was the apprenticeship union rep at the time, and told Al that I should be taken off the apprenticeship because I don't know anything. His name was Ted, as I can't remember his last name right off hand. But he was a gnarly old guy, and I always kind of prided myself as getting on the good side of everybody at least once. So I worked pretty hard with him, and we ended up being pretty good partners after a while. And I found that actually he didn't know it as much as I did. I thought it was justice.
Well, you've shared your first boss and your first partner. Can you share a little bit about what did you think of the plant and the people and what was going on? I know you peeked in the windows as a kid, but had you ever really put into perspective the assembly line?
No, I was absolutely amazed when I went in there and saw all those people standing along this conveyor line, especially up in the old trim shop on the second floor. At one time, this plant has held many records in its time. But at one time, this plant had the longest continuous conveyor line in the world, well over a half mile long. And that was amazing. Going down to the body shop in what they used to call the jungle, which we're kind of coming back to a little bit, back there at the last part where you had all the manual guns, you could literally have trouble passing through these guns if you tried to cross the line. It was dirty. It was smoky. It was loud. Sparks going all over the place from the weld guns. They were bodybuilding pallets at the time, weighed probably 2,500, 3,200 pounds on this big chain. And they go in and they go down a hill and they disappear from sight. They go through a tunnel and they come up someplace else and a big machine would put parts on there, and I'm just flabbergasted. And I'm going, I never thought anything would be like this. You know, I never thought about building a car, except racing. But it was really a little scary, you know. And I was at NOM, you know. I didn't think anything could faze me. But I mean, this was holy Christ, you know. Something's gonna hit me. Something's gonna knock me down. But after a while, you get a third eye, and you get a very good sense of where you are and where you're standing.
So you remember the guy you hired in with? Did he? Is he still with us? Did he continue to work?
Yeah, Kenny works over at plant two. He might be a good candidate for that and for this kind of interview if you're interested in him. We have the same seniority, same time, and he's just younger, so he gets to work a little longer than me. But we kind of teamed up, just being the new kids on the block. He was a millwright. I had a trade as an electrician.
Thinking back, were there any new hire initiations or pranks that were done to you, or did you get to reciprocate?
No. They didn't mess with me. I was probably just about a half a bubble off coming out of Vietnam. I had a lot of attitude, and I had a lot of hostility, and you know, that kind of conflicted with trying to get along with everybody. But they didn't goose me or anything, because I probably would have broke their arms. I did hurt a couple guys a couple times, and basically they just kind of left me alone. I didn't do it to anybody, and they didn't do it to me, and that's just fine.
So there was no prank, you just kind of hurt somebody.
Yeah.
Can you give a physical appearance? Did you have a long hair back then?
When I hired him, I got out of the service in late January 1970. And from that time on, I decided I wasn't going to get my hair cut. Uncle Sam could tell me to cut my hair. He could shoot me for not doing it. But I figured there's nobody in this world going to tell me how to wear my hair anymore. I earned my right to do what I wanted to. And for that time until I hired in, about a year and a half, I grew my hair. And when I came in, Mr. Kushmal says, you're going to have to cut your hair. And I says, sir, I refuse to cut my hair. And he said, well, it may be an issue later. We don't want long hair around here. And I told him that if he didn't want long hair around here, he could talk to my lawyer. Because he's the height. And so went in there, and the guys would fool with it a little bit once. And I just out of spite, I guess, after a while, I let my beard grow almost down to my navel and my hair the same length, too. And when I worked, I'd wrap it up and I'd stick it under my shirt and put the hair under my hat. And they found that a guy with hair and a beard could actually do things. And I think I gained their respect, and I know I respect them.
You have a nickname. Could you share that, and is it connected at all?
Yeah, I have a nickname. That nickname came about, I was probably about, maybe the third year of the apprenticeship. And we had gone out one afternoon and had a few cocktails. And then we brought a few cocktails back in with us because it was so much fun. In retrospect, it was stupid, but hey, it was fun then. Well, anyway, at that time, as I said, I generally wore my hair up under a hat and my beard inside my shirt. Well, as the night progressed, my hair became more and more disheveled and fuzzed out and everything. And one of the fellas, Al Peacock, looked at me and he says, you're all frizzed out. And he laughed and he giggled and he says, Frisbee. And the name stuck. I kind of liked it. I kind of like not having my real name when I'm in any group of people anyway. And this one worked out good. I had a lot of fun with it over the years. And then as I got more and more cocky and more sure of myself, I became not only Frisbee, but I became the Mighty Frisbee. And I am still, to many people, the Mighty Frisbee. And of course, I play that for all it's worth. It's fun.
Well, you shared a little bit about going out and coming back in. Can you share what it was like in the old days, taking a lunch break. They were a little longer than they are now, correct?
No.
No?
No. It was a half hour. We had a half hour. Basically, what I did, I was, my parents, as I said, lived across the street, and most generally during lunch, when I was on days especially, I would just go home, fix a sandwich, you know, my mom might fix something for me because, you know, as I said, I was living at home. And as I moved out to East Lansing, and that, after I got out of service, I didn't move out because I was living in East Lansing before I went to service. But as I got harder and harder, to, you know, as I moved further away, I'd bring my own lunch. I very seldom went to the bar because I know that my proclivities are, I generally get in trouble somehow if I have too much spare time or anything like that.
Frizz, get ready, Judy. You hired in as an apprentice. Can you tell us what that involves and how long you have to be an apprentice to get your journeyman's card?
Well, it's a pretty structured thing. There's so many hours you have to spend bending conduits, so many hours you have to spend repairing this or working on it. At the time it was 12 volt or high cycle stuff. I'm working on various machines and doing this, and a lot of repair, a lot of troubleshooting. Very rigorous, very by the hour, 800 hours of this, 200 hours of this, until you get around, I don't know, 70, I'm an apprentice coordinator now, I don't even know. About 7,200, let's say 7,300 hours worth of on-the-job training, plus at that time, well, and still this time, you had to fulfill certain educational requirements, and those were laid out. For example, electrical blueprint reading, trigonometry, geometry, and that stuff. In my particular apprenticeship, I had gone to school. I had a lot of that stuff up front, and they used to pay you by the hour to go to school. For every hour you were in class, you got paid your hourly rate, which, by the way, was $4.06 an hour when I started. When I started, I told those guys, I'm not working for less than $4 an hour. $4.06, man. They fell right into that one. But we did that, and you buy your books, and then they would they give you your hourly rate to go to school, which wasn't bad. It was not bad for me. And unfortunately, I took that as meaning that if I went to school for 6 hours a week, then I'd work for 34 hours a week, because I understood that I was required only to be there 40 hours. And so I did that for quite some time. My supervisors didn't particularly care for it. I didn't work weekends, because most of those weekends I was drag racing. I was quite a professional at the time. I was actually quite good. Our car ran, at that time, it ran 3/10 under the national record, which was pretty good. So I, you know, there came to be a point where one of my supervisors, Jack Smith, a retired colonel out of the Army, who kind of took me under his wing, realizing that I was a veteran, and that I didn't come out with a lot. I came out with a few bruises, let's put it that way. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he informed me that, Frizz, while I appreciate the fact that you're, you know, almost professional racer, you've got to make a choice here, son. Are you going to race or are you going to work here? You have to commit to one or the other. He says, be sorry to lose you if you go racing. He said, we'd be more than happy to keep you on. And I was pretty close to losing my job because of that. And so I weighed my options, and I went, well, I got insurance, I got dental, I got this, I got a good job and a great bunch of people to work with, and I'm having a lot of fun. So I guess I'll back off on my racing career, which I did do. And, you know, but I still race.
Earl Nicholson, Frisbee, your skilled trades and skilled trades, they handle a lot of emergencies. Is there any special emergency that you were called to that's memorable? Was anybody hurt?
I in a lot of ways, I was lucky in not having anyone severely hurt that I had to pull out of trouble. Actually, more of the stuff like that that happened was recently. You know, I mean, back when the plant was still running, when we had the power failures and stuff, I got to be, I guess, thought of as being pretty much the guy, the go-to guy when anything went screwy. And I always was on night shift because I liked it better there. And when something went bad, you'd have power failures, you'd have conveyor breakdowns, a chain would break, cars would come out of the ceiling over there in Building 23 off that big decline. They'd always call me to kind of run the show. I guess I had a pretty good feeling for the building, where everything was, how to do all of this stuff. And it's kind of fun. It's a good feeling to do a good job. Part of my job was also keeping a management away from my fellas, even as a manager, just getting them out of there, not bothering my fellas when they're trying to concentrate on what they're doing. There's a lot of good feelings in that. Makes me feel actually competent.
Well, you just went from sharing that you were an electrician and learning the trade. Now you said that you were keeping management away from your guys. So would you please lead us to where, how long were you in the trade and what decision did you make to move forward?
Okay, well, excuse me. I think I carry about 10 years actual tool time, full-time tool time. And then I got delusions of grandeur. One day, I basically just, I kind of got fed up with the style of management that they had at the time. Back in those days, you know, when you consider I hired in 71 and 38 they had the sit-down strike, am I correct? And that's only, you know, that's only 30 years. And they went from shooting people, these blessed union people, I'm telling you, the union make this country great. They've raised the level of living for these guys. And these guys died for this. Well, anyway, the management style there was pretty authoritarian, pretty much, I have you under my thumb, you do what I say. And I got tired of the supervisors coming around and just jumping in, guys, just getting on them for no, what I considered no reason. So I went out one day and just cut my hair off and signed up for supervision, and they thought it was a joke. They thought I was just doing something. I guess I had kind of a reputation as being a little off-kilter at some times, you know, not harmful, but to just look at things differently. And they asked me if I was serious, and I says yes. And they said, why? I says, I'm tired of the way management's running the place. I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to subvert, I guess. And they took me on, and I don't think they've been unhappy. But I have a very proprietary relationship with my guys. I love my guys. I love my people that work for me and work with me. It makes me feel good to take an employee that may have a little problem and coach and counsel them and watch them blossom. You know, when I was a tradesman, my hand tools were my tools. Now my people are my tools, the things that I need to aid me to get my job done.
Doug Rademacher, you just shared a little bit about union. Go a little further. Did you consider your union serving you well? Did you consider running for a union position prior to going on salary?
I figured the union did as well as it could under the circumstances. But as in any organization, I feel you get three people and you got politics. You know, you got two people that get along, three people means politics. I didn't think I could make the changes I wanted if I was an actual union guy. I tell the guys kind of jokingly, I may have even said it to you, I'm a better union man now that I'm on supervision than I was when I was hourly. Because I appreciated what they did. I never made committee calls. You know, I'd always get busted for something, but I set myself up for it, you know. When I was on hourly, but, you know, that was just my normal hell-raising nature. But, you know, I think the union's done a wonderful job, you know.
Cheryl McQuaid. First, there's been always a lot of talk about the hourly and the skilled trades arenas not getting along very well. How did you look at the hourly on the line? How did you view them?
As a tradesman, they really, it was like going to the mall. You know, you see a lot of people there. You can tell what they're doing, kind of. But it never really impacted my life. When I was in the body shop, which ended up being a truly interesting thing for me, running an area, having people working, you get to talk to the people, you get to learn a little bit about them, you get to learn their quirks, you get to learn what makes them happy. And I always tried to keep my area running right, because, as I said before, I'm pretty lazy. And I figured that if you go out and do everything you need to do, you know, take care of it, the people won't be gnarly. You know, and if you say, I'll get to it, they believe you. You know, I always like to, I have a lot of credibility with the production folks, and as well as my trade brothers, you know.
Did any production person ever ask you to do a government work for them? And if so, what kind of government work did you do for them?
Yes. I would help them do just about anything they asked. I'd do anything for them that I could do. There's that dichotomy there as you know, are you stealing from the company? Well, you know, many of us kind of overlook that in a way. It's not right. It takes money. But on the other hand, it's called a people pleaser. You know, a guy that has trouble doing stuff, he brings his chainsaw in and say, hey, Frizz, can you get a screw for this or make this up? I just made that man's life very happy. You know, he's happy now. You know, he sends a little ray of sunshine in the world. I helped him out do anything I could for the guys most of the time. Some guys would, of course, would try to take advantage of it, and they got shut off.
Doug Rademacher, now you just described something. Cheryl asked you about a government job. Can you what does that mean? I mean, if we're talking to students that have never worked in the auto industry, what is a government job?
Well, a government job is a euphemism for doing work or acquiring things for folks that they wouldn't normally have. If a guy wants a handful of nuts or bolts and he wants them put together on something, and your boss comes in and asks you what you're doing, rather than say, hey, I'm working on Cheryl's lawnmower here, very hard to get a lawnmower in, but that's the first word that came to my mind. I'm fixing it for. I'm doing a little government work, you know, for Uncle Sam. It just a way to say it's not directly connected to your assigned work.
Okay, and so that means you would be allowed to do that, but if something came up,
there's different kinds of people. There's some supervisors you didn't want to, you know, let in. You didn't want them to have anything on you. You didn't want them to have any leverage over you. So, you just play it smart. You know, you're not going to sit there and advertise that fact. But then again, you didn't really hide it either.
Earl Nicholson, Frizz. You hired in 1971. You went right to skilled trades. Were there many women or minorities in the skilled trades at that time?
No women, and me as a minority, because I was the first hippie in the maintenance department. There were probably 6 to 8, and I could be wrong. If you showed me the seniority list for then, I could tell you who was what. Probably 6 to 8 black men in the millwright trade. A couple of Hispanics, one Puerto Rican that I can think of in the tool repair trade. We had several different trades and quite a few more than we got nowadays. On a whole, there was probably less than 5% of minorities, and women, I can think of two women that were in the tool repair trade, and that was it.
So can you remember the first woman to come in to become an electrician? She never worked
for you. I'm thinking that might have been Linda Day. No, she's in the, there was I kind of mixed up. There's Terry Brummel. She hired as an apprentice because we were really getting hammered for EEO jobs. EEO requirements.
What is EEO?
Equal Employment Opportunity. GM was very, very out of norm for what the government would say that the proper percentages be. I think Linda Day, I think, was the first one that I can remember.
Could you
an EIT.
Could you tell us what was it like for her? I mean, was it difficult for her? Did the guys give her a hard time?
Well, as Doug pointed out earlier, asking about the pranks, and you have to go through a certain rite of passage. Everybody takes it in a different way. Linda did very well. She could bark back. She had a backbone. She just didn't hide in the corner and bat her eyelids. She really tried to do a good job, and that was good. And she was accepted by, you know, anybody that had a brain in their head as a good person. And that's kind of the way I never really perceived any discriminatory stuff, you know, in this way. Well, don't talk to him, he's black. Don't talk to him, he's a woman. I never really, of course, maybe my mind overlooks it because I don't do it at all myself. It doesn't make any difference to me. But I don't recall hearing much of it. You know, most of the discrimination was at that time was aimed at hippies.
Wow, hippies!
Oh yeah.
All right, I'd like to go slightly in another direction here.
That's a good call.
I'd like you to tell us, how was your relationship with the powerhouse guys? I heard that they could be a pretty arrogant group of people.
I never had any problem with those guys. In fact, I was in the powerhouse with Cliffy Eshelby, and that was basically a kind of a... they were orphans, if you want to call it that. I mean, they were left to their own. They had to loot and steal because their, you know, supervision, their management really wasn't competent enough to never mind. They weren't really competent. And so if we wanted anything, we had to go find it ourselves or whatever. And they weren't arrogant. They were unloved, you know. Just like a dog you leave out in the backyard and never give a bone to, you know. They got gnarly. But I never had any problem with them.
Did you have a lot of respect for those guys? Because that powerhouse that they were managing was like built back in the...
1922. I got prints. 1922. That's when a lot of the plant was put up. A lot of the big plant, because it used to be the Durant plant. And that brick facade on there is the same brick facade as the one down in the corner there at the bedding store, B&L, whatever it is, right across the street from the pub. That used to be the Durant showroom. And if you look at it, you'll see the beauty of that actual brickwork in that place. It's always amazed me. They were good guys, you know. They were misunderstood.
Since we got to the minorities and the women, did you, after having them brought on board and the numbers, did you ever feel that was unjust, or did you feel like, was it long overdue, and did it ever impact the quality?
That in my mind, if you can do the job, you can do it. The only thing that I've noticed, with the exception of one female millwright, strong as an ox, the ladies physically weren't able to do a lot of the heavy overhead work. But, and I'm going to say that most of them didn't stay in the background. I mean, it takes a lot of guts to decide you're going to be a tradesperson in a basically a man's environment, or what's perceived as a man's environment. They did pretty well. Some of them, you know, just like anybody, I thought they were a number. And that's probably as unkind as I've ever thought about it. But in the main, they were pretty dedicated. They tried, at least the first ones, you know, they tried, the ones I really worked directly with, they tried very hard to make a place for themselves and be considered competent.
Doug Rademacher. Carl, did you have any brothers and sisters when you grew up?
Yes, I do. I have two younger brothers. And if you put us together, we'd be triplets.
My question to you then is, did there come a time working inside the Fisher Body plant that the workers became your brothers and sisters?
I have very few friends through the plant. I have many close relationships with the guys when I'm at work, but I don't see them afterward. I compartmentalize my life a lot. When I'm at work, I'm at work. You know, and I'm playing with my friends. When I'm at home, I'm playing with my other friends. They don't mix too much.
So tell us, Earl Nicholson, tell us, Frizz, you were talking about supervision here a while ago. You were saying that you wanted to make a change. Could you tell us what made a good supervisor, what made a bad supervisor?
Well, I think you could answer that, Earl. I think all you folks sitting here at the table have your opinions on what makes a good supervisor. But I allow my people, I work very hard at allowing my people to have integrity. I work very hard at respecting my people, and I expect the same from them. I tell them I don't lie, cheat, or steal to them. If they want something, I'll give it to them. I'll do the best I can, and when I ask for something, I better have it. It's a very much of a give-and-take thing. So, I think a good supervisor has a backbone. He's willing to go to the wall for his boys, his people. Even my women are boys, as far as I'm concerned. My boys, my guys, and I will back them. And like I tell my fellas, I says, don't lie to me, because then I can't lie for you. You gotta always tell me the truth. And they do. And there's a certain thing that, you know, that develops in for that. You know, we're all in this together. It's not, you know, I mean, if you're wrong, I'm going to tell you you're wrong. If you did wrong, you're going to pay. Basically, you do it to yourself. I don't do it to you. I'm not after you. You're just not fitting into what I've agreed that the working conditions or the code of conduct is. And these guys do very, very well at that, because they know that I'll take care of them.
Doug Rademacher. Carl, you wanted to make a change. You didn't like the way management ran. Does anything stand out that you were instrumental in changing, that you hold dear to your heart?
Nah, nothing I can think of, other than I'm just an absolutely wonderful person, and people actually clamor to work for me. And that makes me feel very good. That makes me feel really, really, you know, almost self-serving in the fact that I get such a good feeling out of it. You know, folks on the line, you know, they like me because, you know, hey, Frizz, I always have time for them. Why? It's my job. You know, if you're stepping on a platform that has plywood on it and plywood's up an eighth of an inch, you know, first I was thinking, geez, what a dumb thing to do. And then I started thinking, back in the days when we were running 70 jobs an hour and you're working 9.5 hours a day, well, 720 jobs, 720 times you're tripping or stumbling over that, and you feel it through your shoes, and it drives you nuts. I always used to think, you know, do what a dog would do, walk around it. But that means that people aren't as smart as a dog. And then I realized, hey, put yourself in their place. Watch them, you know. So, you know, you go out and you take care of the stuff for the people. And it's, so they're happy. They don't fall down. They don't have an aching back or a sprained ankle or something because they're dodging the bad spot. That's the kind of stuff that I like to see. That's the kind of change that I think I made. I look at my paint shop where I'm working now at LDT. My manager worked very hard at assembling a crew of people that actually kind of have the same beliefs and work code that I do. And I think they've done a marvelous job so far. And I always wait and see. But in the main, at least in the paint shop, everybody loves everybody. I mean, there's a lot of camaraderie. That's what I want. I'm not your boss. My job is to give you a job.
It sounds like you were very concerned for your workers. Working at a factory is, like you said, when you hired in, the feeling was you're in here and you're mine, and you're under my thumb. Sounds like you recognized people's problems. Did you have anyone where you were able to help them through a trying time, so they didn't lose their job? Or
there's several, and I prefer not to go into that. When I'd see somebody getting dealt a bad hand, I'd stand up for him. He was an hourly guy. It wasn't right. You know, it wasn't unusual for me to go right up to the personnel and, hey, guy's getting a bad shake. You know, I put myself out for him. However, they didn't know it. I'd never tell them. But, you know, that's the way it is. You got to take care of people. I don't have to like everybody, but I certainly have to take care of them.
There were many different plant managers from the time you hired in.
Oh, hi, Pockets.
Anybody hang, anyone, you could run through a few of them, but anyone stand out as being a great person to work for and the people?
Well, there was Tom Weathorn. He was always fun. I just enjoyed watching the man walk. They called him High Pockets. He probably stood about 6'6", white-haired, very distinguished, very slim gentleman. And then there was Leonard Red Borma, three, and he was the director of plant engineering around that time. And it always just used to just give me the I'd watching them walk down the aisles together. And let's see, there was Don Chenoweth. He was in there, and then there was Buckmaster, Dick Buckmaster. He was a production manager He was quite a character. I really enjoyed Dick the whole time he was working there. He just, for some reason, he and I just formed a bond. And as an early supervisor, he would actually call down to the maintenance area and say, you know, or have, you know, just, where's Frisbee? Tell him to come down. He's got a meeting with the manager, meeting with the plant manager. And we go down and we discuss things. He used me as a sounding board for some of the stuff. I found him a man of great integrity. He was also somebody you never wanted to cross. They all used to laugh about him. If Buck got on you, it would be you've been buckaroo. When you got buckaroo. You didn't particularly care for. He was a very good man. I also had a lot of.
Well, that you bumped heads with, that you didn't like, or that you didn't get along with, or you didn't respect,
I probably bumped heads with just about everybody. I don't know if it's a powerful personality, or I'm just a gnarly son of a bitch, but most people, it seemed, worked really hard at not doing their job or getting out of it or sloughing it off to somebody else. My work ethic when I grew up with my dad, that was not allowed. You take your job, you shoulder your load, and you do it. And many of the times that we bumped heads, it was because of my perceived feeling that they were unwilling to do their share.
So tell me the name change with Fisher Body and BOC and
I didn't know what part of the alphabet I was in. We were Fisher Body, and then as we became one with Chassis, I was early in supervision at the time, and Fisher Body people, the Fisher Body organization, was not oriented toward construction, etc. I mean, it wasn't in the time studies. You didn't get an eighth of a man for this. However, Chassis, there was a whole different culture over there. Snooty SOBs, I always thought. I really had nothing to do with them. I didn't care for the Chassis. I didn't care for the way that they always had a procedure for this. They always had a rule for this. They always had a way to do it. It was all done on paper. They lived in a paper world. Fisher Body, at least the maintenance crew, we do it and talk about it later. Mm-hmm. Let's get the job done. We'll pick up the pieces. We'll figure out how much it costs. We'll figure out how to... These guys, they'd analyze things to death, and they wouldn't do anything. But they were always better than us, and that just kind of irritated me.
Assholes.
So tell me, Frizz.
I thought of that.
Tell me, Frizz. You've worked in the old factory, and I believe that you're one of the people responsible for setting up the new factory. Can you tell us the difference between where we were at with the old factory in terms of quality and where we're moving in the new world with the new factory that we've got coming?
As I said before, I'm not a book guy. You know, I work really hard at making my job so I don't have to write reports, etc. In the old plant, I had everybody scared of me, so they didn't have me do this. In the new plant, I do see that, somebody said, you know, if those who don't study history are condemned to repeat it. And in the new dawn, they have a lot more bookwork documentation. This shows that I must be getting senile. I actually support some of that. Because there's a lot, in today's automotive marketplace, you know, a lot of these folks are eating our lunch, and that makes me sad, because you got a great bunch of people that actually, if you really consider about it, the automotive industry had a lot to do with making America great. Batten, the satellite stuff, the steel industry, the plastic industry, the rubber, the software, you know, computers and all of this. This all comes from the cars, if you really look at it, you know. And America being the way it is, so disjoint and so decentralized, having an automobile is something you need. And I really, you know, and I think that we're doing a good job. We're getting a lot of pressure. We're getting a lot of people looking at us, and I think that we've got a good thing going if we can just keep it going. I like what Randy did inverting the structure. Instead of a pyramid, we got a funnel, and you know where stuff goes when it goes in the funnel. It goes right to the bottom. And that's where Randy is. He's the guy that's supposed to be able to take care of the problems. As they say in the GMS training, a little theme music here. You know, you tell us what you need to do your job, and we'll do the best we can to get it. I don't want him to lose sight of that. That's what brought me into this organization. I'm waving the flag. If I wouldn't have said, pick me, I could have been retired at 97%. I find out later. But I believe what we're trying to do is a good thing. And I believe that empowering the folks to actually make decisions and stick with them is the best thing.
So, okay.
I've been, Josefina Martinez, I've been through the GMS training, but one thing that stands on me is the reason that we have this oval shape, like you said, instead of the pyramid. Is it because General Motors finds its way in the stages that it's at, you know, the bankruptcy and the sourcing and all that they finally give some of that knowledge for us, the labor people, or the production people? Do you feel that might be a
change? I'm going to say that I don't think I think it's perceived power that is not relinquished easily by management. The real power in the whole organization of the people. Having someone, the GMS, they were set up a long time ago. That little arrow going in the target, you know, you saw all of that stuff a long time ago. That's when it started. And that also started when, pretty much when they got rid of a lot of the good old boys, and this is my perception, got rid of the good old boys on the board, got some outside people in and says, hey, you guys, you're too rigid. You got to flow. You got to be able to adapt to the marketplace. And they came up with the GMS idea. I think Randy took it one step further in actually codifying it and saying, this is the way we're going to try to run the organization. I think he's the first one. Maybe he isn't, but I sure like it, and the people like it. They like to be able to, you know, feel that what they say will be taken as a valid input. And there's a lot of frustration, and that's, you know, I was frustrated when I was out. I'm still frustrated. What do you think of a guy that's got 25 years as a flipping supervisor and hasn't been promoted? Well, that's the kind of trouble I make for myself. But now in this new organization, hey, I'm one row from the top. So I like that.
That's interesting.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So, Friz, I know that the hour is late, and as you've said before, you're bouncing seven different projects now all at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so happy that we finally got you in here to tell us your story. Doug Rademacher.
Yeah, well, sounds like you're trying to close, and I wanted to find out, as you drive by here today and you see, we'll call it the Fisher plant.
It makes me sad.
I see that already. Could you share a little bit about your life here?
Just makes me sad. Well, I'm almost crying. But, you know, I mean, a lot of emotion. But in 5 minutes, I'll be okay. You know, it's just, I've been everywhere. I watched Building 3X get built. I watched 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 get built. I remember, as a child, when plant security was there, riding our bicycles down through where the old cushion room used to be before they built Building 17 and 16, and having the plant security guys chase us. I mean, that's my history. I used to look down where the marshalling area used to be by plant security is through the windows in the window, and that's where the cafeteria used to be. I remember looking at these guys saying, no goddamn way in the world am I going to work at an automotive plant, and no way in the world am I going to be an electrician. I wish I would have decided not to be something else, you know, but I ended up being this way, and I sure enjoyed it. I got a lot of happy memories, some of them fuzzy, but hey, you know, that's life, and it's a good place to work. And I like knowing everything about that place.
So tell me, Friz.
Thanks for cracking me up.
So tell me, Friz.
Edit that.
Did you ever climb the smokestack?
Yes, I did. I climbed it because I was scared to death of heights. I went up there, and that was before they had the fall restraints on it. And I went up there. I went up there and looked, and you can see a long ways from up at the top of that stack, and it took me 2.5 hours to get down because I was so scared. But I, you know, that's a thing. You know, you got to challenge yourself. You got to take yourself out of your shell, your envelope. I would never do this for anybody else but you guys.
So
you got more out of me in this last hour and 20 minutes than anybody has. It's because I love my plan.
So here we are, Friz. I am assuming we're coming up on the close here as I look around the room. There are no more hands up.
Nobody's sleeping.
No, we're listening.
You are not.
As you know, all this information is for the Michigan State Labor Studies Program. Very, very soon here in the future, that factory will cease to exist, and I mean physically, as we know they're tearing it down. Are there any memories or words Any insights, any warnings to the future for the people who are in the labor studies group that are going to view this tape?
No, but I'm going to tell you something. I asked my dad, who's 83 years old now and lives in the same home that I grew up in, 1955 or 54, 83. And I says, Poppy, I said, what are you going to do? What do you think you're going to do when that plant's gone? And he says, well, boy, he says, I don't know. And I said, well, I know what you're going to get for him when the plant's gone. He says, what? I says, you're going to get some sunsets. We live so close to the plant, you never got to see the sunset. Which is interesting. What's going to be there next?
Well, I just want to think back to one quick moment, since this is on yours, and I played ball in that backfield behind your parents' home, and sometimes we wouldn't put the balls up on top of Harry's place. We'd put them in your backyard, and there was a fear back
windows.
There, because what'd you have over there? Looked like a beast.
Well, it was a boxer. But that dog wouldn't hurt anybody. I know that the kids that sometimes, because we used to have windows in the little addition that Pop put on the back of the garage, and that was quite a target, because I was a little older then, and I wasn't. And as we graduated from the field down to Verlinden, because you could hit the balls further, Harry didn't particularly care for it either when you put one out in the middle of the parking lot and bust somebody's windshield. We all thought that was kind of funny. But as we graduated, we moved away from the little field, the little postage stamp field, and I went out there the other day, and you can still see where home plate was. You still see that rock right by second base that you were all scared to death you're going to hit and brain yourself. It's still there, and a lot of it's still in my brain, too, because I remember that.
I remember it well, too. Is there anything you would say to people in the future, people that are coming after us?
Well, today's society seems to be pretty much a throwaway. We don't build for substance. We don't build for heritage, it doesn't seem. Mm-hmm. I look at the way this new plant's put up, and it's nothing but cardboard and clothespins as far as I'm concerned. I don't see that place being there for how long?
1890s.
Well, no, that was downtown. But like I said, most of the place was built in the early 20s. And Billy Durant, whenever he's doing that plant there, you know, has style and substance. You know, it's an old veteran, and you're not going to see it in the throwaway stuff we got now.
Hmm.
And I guess that's what I want to pass on. Regardless of what kind of environment you're in, it's people like the union, people like GM, that you can't keep a building forever, but you can sure try to make a heritage and pass that kind of stuff on, the kind of thoughts and the kind of work ethic and all of this stuff. We're losing a lot of that. As an old son of a bitch, I can look back now, I know I was old and saying, you know, these kids nowadays, they don't know how to make change. They don't know how to address an envelope. They don't know how to do a waltz with a girl. You used to do that in grade school. That was part of it. You know, that was part of your socialization. I think America is forgetting socialization of the young folks. In our God Almighty rush to make sure that we're all doing algebra by the time we're out of sixth grade. Those kind of core values, at least where I was, where I'm at, and where most of you probably are, I think they're not being addressed. You know, I guess that's going to pass that on. You know, don't be afraid to have a history. Don't be afraid to inculcate some kind of heritage.
Well, thank you, Frizz.
Thanks, Frizz.
Thank you.
Thank you.